Good afternoon, everyone. This is another episode of the Rain King podcast. What I'm going to do today is have a guest who I've been developing something of a rapid acquaintance with. His YouTube channel is Genosse Red Cat. For those that don't know, Genosse means comrade in German. And as such, him and I will discuss a few things about the world, my own development, his own development, so on and so forth. This is going to be something of a part one, because we're going to strive to set up a part two for a video or conferencing of some sort. I'll just have to see what the resources I have available are, and go from there. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this, I hope this works, and feel free to suggest any further topics or guests you would like on my show. Enjoy.
Hello, can you hear me? Hello, can you hear me?
Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
Right, we are on. How are you today? Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, great. Okay, just screen is online. Yeah.
All right.
And perfect. Even the chat seems to work. So
sounds great.
Hello, everyone. I'm here today with the Rain King. And as far as I know, you're in America. Is that right?
Yes, Philadelphia, to be exact.
Oh, okay. So I'm from Switzerland. And could you maybe talk about yourself a bit? Like,
sure, absolutely. My name is Franco. I am in my late 20s. And I was originally born in New York City. Of parents of French extraction. I was born and raised in New York City, and then after about 20 plus years of living in New York City, I moved to Philadelphia. Through my life, I've experienced the realities of being a working class male in today's society, in a hyper-capitalistic society, and I saw a lot of injustice in and around, you know, area in my world. I initially started out as a libertarian, believe it or not, when I was in my teenage years and starting to get politically active. Then I ended up becoming more of a right winger as a reaction to the world I saw around me. And then as time went on, I eventually developed into more of a state socialist slash Marxist Leninist, where I'm at right now.
Oh, okay. Okay. I see. So, I've seen you watch Caleb Maupin, but you call yourself also a patriotic socialist. And I sometimes repost things you post because I think we are very much alike in positions. Yeah, so I'm a Marxist-Leninist and I use Marxism-Leninism in the age today, like I try to use it. I've also studied Mao Zedong. I've studied works of Xi Jinping. I've studied even older works like Karl Liebknecht. So, yeah. But I would subscribe to modern socialism. You might want to call it Dengism, whatever.
Right, and I can say that I appreciate everything that you share. Certain things, because as you said, we are more similar than we might think. For those that aren't aware, I do have a podcast of my own called the Rain King Podcast. I also have a Instagram page at the Rain King Franco. And I'm starting to develop a YouTube page myself. You know, as of right now, it's just me. You know, It's talking about the state of the world, but it's developing as it'll develop as time goes on.
Yeah, that sounds good. I just wonder why you're not doing this on YouTube but on Anchor, because I've never like used Anchor before.
Right. Well, for those that don't know, Anchor is a podcast company. And when I first started to think about making a podcast, something to get my voice more out there, I did not have the resources, if you will, that I do now. And so Anchor was the only thing that would work on my phone at that time.
Oh.
And that was kind of the way I just went about things. You know, YouTube wasn't really as active on the resources I had as I do now. Now I've managed to save some money, get something a little bit better. Mm-hmm. And now it's starting to get off the ground, if you will. But that's one of the drawbacks of being a working class man. You have to work with whatever you have available, and it may not always be the best, but you know, as long as it functions, you work with what you have.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I began like with a very, very, very shitty webcam, but I had good audio. And then eventually I finally managed, because this was like during coronavirus, I finally managed to get a 1080p webcam, and now I finally have one. And the quality got a lot better, and so the viewership rose as well, and I mean the subscribership also.
Precisely, because I think people are looking for quality content. And even if, let's say, the video quality is either non-existent or not that great, as long as you have solid audio and solid talking points, they should start coming around.
I'm just not sure if Anchor is like the best place. Do you have a lot of subscribers on here, or is anyone listening in?
I have a handful, but I would argue that's more due to my sort of infrequent podcasting rather than anything else. I do tend to mainly put episodes up when the mood strikes me.
Yeah.
I'm not as consistent as I need to be, and that's something I'm still fleshing out as time goes on.
Uh-huh.
That's something I'm working on as we speak. Mm-hmm. But I would argue that just reading about how the communists developed and how different nations developed their own version of socialism, I think that's sort of given me a boost, if you will, in the sense that I need to be the best example, if you will, of Marxism or of socialism that I can be. And that's something that I think doesn't get as much, I guess, coverage, if you will. And I think what made it click for me was when I watched the Caleb Maupin video in which he said revolutionaries wear suits. That's the actual title. And he mentions frequently that, you know, when he would go to communist conferences all over the world, he would find that a lot of socialists and communists from other countries, from Asia, Africa, the Middle East, so on and so forth, they would wear suits, you know. Yeah. They would try to look presentable. They would try to be the best example of their ideology. And he said the contrast to America was that the
Western
American,
leftists.
You know, Western leftists, yes, tend to be a bit more, I guess, sloppy in attire. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not just that one thing alone that dooms it all, but rather it's just a visual representation of what they have, you know. Mm-hmm. Ended up becoming. And that is, I think, one of the things that's the reason why it took so long for me to become a leftist, to be quite honest,
yep.
Because a lot of what I saw of leftism is what I now call, or rather Caleb Maupin calls, the synthetic left,
yeah.
Or the boutique left, however you want to apply it. And you find out that it's
liberal.
Yeah, latte liberals, champagne liberals. Yeah, there's a slew of names for them. But those that aren't aware, the Western left has unfortunately descended into toadies for the establishment. Mm-hmm. You know, they are the ones that are preoccupied heavily on identity politics, on your sexism, your racism, and things like that. Yeah. And that's not to downplay any of those issues, but I personally argue that it's a symptom of classism. It's a symptom of our capitalist system in the sense that, you know, they parallel each other.
Yeah.
You know, if you're treated like dirt because you're poor,
It doesn't make sense to fight this under capitalism, but we should do it after capitalism, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I completely agree, because like oh, we need to liberate women under capitalism, not under socialism, while capitalism is oppressing the woman in the first place. Like, it makes no sense. It's just going to reappear. It's symptom fighting. It's not fighting the cause. So you mentioned Khaled Morpin. Were you in any political organization? Are you now in any political organization?
All honesty, at the moment, I'm kind of an independent, and that's kind of how I am at the moment. I briefly did political campaigning right around 2010 during the whole Tea Party era. I was trying to help a local politician in New York run for what's called the public advocate, which is like a New York city centered position in which you basically advocate for the people. But given it's a heavily Democrat city and the person I was helping was a Republican, it just became a picket's charge. It became a fool's errand, if you will. But I did gain some valuable experience through that. And it did teach me a few things about politics. And then as time went on, I just, met people from all different, political backgrounds, if you will. Despite my being a right winger, I was always more open to meeting anyone and everyone who was willing to listen. But then, as I've said, it made me realize that, I'm sure there are people that legitimately believe in right wingism, but I'm would argue more and more that people believe or become right wing simply as a backlash to our establishment. They tend to see the liberal establishment, the neoliberal consensus, as the left, or whatever they see of the left is just identity politics focused or focused on canceling Dr. Seuss or Mr. Potato Head or all these things that are quite frankly insignificant, but that get a lot of press coverage. And so as a backlash, a lot of people who would actually, a lot of working class people especially, who would make good Marxists and communists and socialists if they understood, what was really going on, they end up becoming right wing simply due to the fact that what people in the West see of the left is the champagne left, is the left who claim to care about the working class. But the second they get into office, there's no universal health care. There's no UBI. There's not even an attempt at making those things. Hold on.
Oh, you're outside.
Yes. Oh. That is both a signature feature of mine and a drawback of my podcast. I tend to do it outside / before work. Some like it, some don't. But I figure once I get a little tiny office space of my own, it should work out.
So you're going to work, or is it morning there? Because I don't even know what time it is there.
Yeah, no. I'll let you know when I really need to start leaving. I am on my way to work, but we have quite a bit of time before I have to. So I'll let you know when I need to start winding down.
Well, I mean, it's healthy to go out. I mean, maybe it's even more interesting to people when you walk around like Khaled Morpin and film yourself walking around.
Absolutely. That's actually what I've started to do with my YouTube channel. And I started doing it on my Instagram as well. I would have like little 60-second videos of me talking about things. And then I started expanding the videos. Yep. And then I started making a YouTube page. So that's something that, it's something that I was doing on my own. But I think once I saw Caleb doing it, it kind of reinforced that this was a good method of going about things,
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I realize that here in Switzerland, the left is a bit different. They are, and that's kind of the difference between America and Switzerland. They are actually social democrats, meaning they do try to push for things. But I mean, it's all tax this, tax that, everything has to be taxed. And it's nothing like, oh, we could have state-run enterprises which finance this or finance that. And so they create the situation where people are like not starving, but they're not getting like, social democrats. They just create a welfare state and basically win the working class over. But like, I mean, they don't really go over to socialism. And then we have like the youth of the Social Democratic Party. And that's really interesting because they talk about socialism because they are like, how do you say, they are infested with Trotskyists. You know, Trotskyists go in their movement, and they try to win them over for their Trotskyist group. So that's what they do. And they kind of more or less act like they're socialists, and they have very socialist slogans like, oh, we need to abolish capitalism, we need to have socialism and all of that stuff. But when it comes down to it, I mean, they say, well, this country isn't socialist. Oh, and this country isn't socialist. And this country, by the way, also isn't socialist, but they do defend Venezuela. Like, or there are some pro-Venezuela supporters, but then, I mean, it's just a complete mix. It's maybe like a bit the Democrats. It's a complete mix of people. But yeah, they more or less steal the working class and people which are interested in socialism, but they don't actually bring you to socialism. And normally people which go in there and are interested in socialism get worn down, and then in their 30s, they go into the Social Democratic Party, like the Mother Party, and then they push for like so-called left-wing policies. And that's kind of the machine, what happens to left-wing interested people in Switzerland.
And I, as you were saying all that, and you mentioned just like the Democrats in America, I agree completely. There's been a bit of a leftist joke I've been hearing lately in that, you know, the Democrats are where leftist movements go to die. And it's just been reinforced as time has gone on, because, you know, Bernie Sanders is about as close to a social Democrat as we'll have in the country, mm-hmm. in America.
Yeah.
But he's been stymied at every turn. And to be honest, the Communist Party is, you know, non-existent, to be quite honest.
Well, I mean, you do have some communist parties. You have like the Communist Party USA, you have like the so-called Party Communist USA, which are a bunch of dogmats in my opinion. Then you have the PSL, you have the the African Socialist Party, then you have New Black Panther Movement, you have the, I think you had the Austin Red Guards or something like that.
Right, but when I say they're you know, almost not existent, it's in the sense that yes, precisely. That's what I was looking for.
Yeah, well, I mean, the only relevant parties here is like the Party of Labour Switzerland, but I mean, I wouldn't even say they're not relevant, but it's like the only communist party in the German-speaking place, well, except the party which I funded, of course. And then there's the party in the Ticino, which is like the Italian speaking part of Switzerland, where there are very based, actually, communists which also talk to China, because the other party doesn't actually talk to China, and they have actually good relations with them. Actually, the one party, the one I spoke before, the Party of Labour Switzerland, has one member in the National Council, which is a state council. It's not the president council. Well, you don't have a president council there, so it's like we have cantons. That's like states in America,
right?
But of course smaller, because America, everything is bigger, including the problems. And so you have these cantons, and each canton has like a few presidents, so-called. And these presidents then go into the National Assembly. And this National Assembly has around, I think, 200 presidents. And then this National Assembly, as far as I remember, votes for 8 people. And these 8 people are like our presidents. And of those 200 presidents, there's one communist. Or, well, you know, the Party of Labour. I wouldn't Like, they're a bunch of dogmats, and you know, and they follow all this identity politics. They don't actually have proper analysis of things.
Right. So we'll just call them synthetics.
Yeah, kind of. Kind of. Yeah. And they have one person in that council. And I mean, that doesn't do too much, does it? And then, of course, you have in the Ticino, which is the Italian-speaking part of Switzerland, you have the Italians, which actually call themselves Communist Party Switzerland. And they, I think, are in the communal assemblies and maybe even... No, I think they're just in communal, but I think they have more or less the entire Italian-speaking part. They're all, everywhere, somewhere, remember. It seems, at least to me.
Well, that's good. And it seems that they're you know, starting to spread a bit more, the Italian-speaking part. And I think that's kind of what's become necessary in the sense that you need parties that can reach out to as many people as possible, you know?
Yeah, sure. But I just don't think their strategy is good, like going around the defending everything. I mean, we kind of defend things, but we don't go around, like, let's say, looking for trouble. We don't, like, post something controversial, like saying, oh, the genocide in Xinjiang is not happening and it's not actually a genocide. Because, I mean, that's just going to put some people off.
Right.
But we focus more on current events in Switzerland and try to have influence there. But I mean, if there's a traditional communist party walking around trying to promote Marxism-Leninism and actually does good analysis, I'm fine with that because that's going to attract other communists. But it's not my way of organizing.
Right, I understand. There's a party in England that I've formed for, and I kind of admire.
Pardon? There's a party in? Your voice just broke up. I couldn't understand this. There's a party in England.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, now it's much better. I don't know what you
Okay.
did.
Yeah. The party that I follow and admire, if you is called the, I think they're the CPGBML.
Marxist-Leninist. Yes.
Yes.
They and George Galloway has the Workers' Party Britain, which is kind of, they're kind of a part of that. Yeah, I really like them too.
Yes, and I admire them simply because they tend to go more towards working class issues, and they tend to try to step away from the identity politics, the secondary issues, if you will. And they tend to say, you know, socialism will bring the working class, period, out of poverty, and it doesn't matter if they're gay, woman, man, you know, trans, it'll bring them all out of poverty. And I agree with that completely.
Yeah. And I think there also, there's this kind of Workers' Party Britain, which tries to have a modern look. They look modern. And then you have the traditional Communist Party, Marxist-Leninist Great Britain, which actually walks around with pictures of Stalin. I don't know if you know that. And yeah, you have like these two ways. And I think both are, I mean, both are exceptional. And I think it's good that they try in both ways. But again, I wouldn't walk around like that. Because...
No, I agree completely. I think if you're trying to drag up old leaders, if you will, it's not going to work because, you know, at least in the West, people have become so propagandized that they kind of believe one narrative and one narrative only, you know, whereas you and I are maybe like breaking out of that narrative and recognizing that what we were told isn't always the truth. There's a lot of people that are still stuck in the narrative. And, you know, I do admire kind of your way and the way of the CPGBML, that's a mouthful, in the sense that you're trying to just focus on like local issues, working class issues, issues that can apply to everyone across the board, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with that completely. And that's kind of what I'm personally trying to do myself. And I'm not attached to any party at the moment, but I strive to explain those genuine working class issues as much as possible. You know, I try to expose the contradictions of capitalism that we are facing right now as much as I can. And that's kind of what I can do at the moment, at least till I can develop a vanguard of some sort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, I'm glad that you admire my way, and I think you've seen how I present the party, like with these bright colors instead of, like, you know, traditional communist red. And I mean, I wouldn't even describe myself as a communist. I would more say I'm a patriotic socialist or something, because
you and I both.
Yeah. I mean, that more describes what the party stands for. And I mean, we do see that with automation and everything, there is a need for the end of capitalism, and that it will end sooner or later. And I mean, we're prepared for that. We have, like, you know, we talk about automation, how it can increase the technology and the well-being in Switzerland, how people can profit from this automation. But that also means that this automation shouldn't be in the hands of rich people, or more of great capitalists or the bourgeoisie, but instead of the state, because the state will take care of this thing and can, for instance, provide free food. For instance, there's this so-called farm bot, actually produced in America, which is capable of planting vegetables. And then the Swiss Institute for something, which does technology research, modified it so it could also, you plant things, and once they grown, you collect
you reap them.
Yes,
harvest.
Yeah, it can harvest. So we have already both ways. One is harvesting, and the other one is planting, and the other is harvesting. And I think with that, you can already do a lot, because if you can plant and harvest, and you can, because it, like, takes it and then throws it into a bucket, that bucket then could be transported to a shop or something, and more or less you could have that on a much larger scale, and you'd have a huge factory for free food.
That sounds like a great idea. And it's interesting you're mentioning automation. I recall in America, there was a lot of talk around what's called universal basic income.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an idea that was attempted in the 70s by Richard Nixon, but it gained new ground now because of a presidential candidate named Andrew Yang.
Mm-hmm.
And he spoke at length about how universal basic income is going to be necessary simply because automation is rapidly on the rise. You know, there's driverless trucks, driverless cars, things of that nature. And what you were mentioning about the food bot, ironic that it was produced in America, but you're going to need some way to mitigate the effects, if you will, of rapid automation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that, like you said, free food is one way, UBI could be another way, so on and so forth. And that would be kind of the way to, again, mitigate a lot of these a lot of the potential disasters.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of, you know, people will say, the rich will, you know, use it and serve it better. But in reality, the state's the only thing to stop these big corporations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, I think, one core principle that I've come to believe in recent years.
Yeah. Well, do you know Boston Dynamics?
Yes. They made the robot dog.
Yeah, this robot dog. And you could, like, put the bucket on the robot dog and it just walks back and forth each time that would be possible, or have one of these running robots. That would be another option. but with the universal basic income, I'm personally not that much a fan, because I feel like there are still some downsides, but I'm not sure if like the prices would reduce. And I have seen by, you probably don't know this YouTuber, by Bad Mouse Productions, which is not around anymore. And he...
That I haven't heard of.
You haven't heard of him?
Unfortunately, no.
Ah. Well, he like did a video on universal basic income, a critique, but the video is gone. And his entire channel is just wiped, because he wiped it. So that's kind of annoying. So I don't really have a clear analysis, like a Marxist critique on universal basic income, which would kind of, you know, debunk this whole thing that, oh, you can just throw money at people and capitalism will just live on forever and ever, because that's essentially what would happen. The big companies would just survive, like, you know, big supermarkets, and you just, like, I think it would go stagnant, maybe. Or do you think there would still be new businesses with a universal basic income?
I do take admittedly a more optimistic view of things. I think if you were to kind of have a universal basic income, you would at the very least lift, like, the bottom 30% out of poverty. So mm-hmm. if people knew their basic needs were covered, you know, with food and with money, they would mm-hmm. have more of a net, if you will, to be able to make new businesses, make new technologies and things like that. I think what stops a lot of people from doing those things is lack of funding, and mm-hmm. the fact that if it fails, you're indigent. You know, you're very, very, you become bankrupt. Mm-hmm. So I think if that, you know, bottom was lifted up, if you will, then there would be ways to develop from there that would be beneficial for the community. And people would say that the big companies would take over, but let's be quite honest, that's kind of what they're doing anyway at the moment, you know, and we don't have any of those protections in place.
Yeah, but I think it would be, I completely agree that you would, that you might lift out those in absolute poverty, because even if you're living on the street, you'd get money. But what I still think is that if you have these big corporations in power of those big automated systems, then they would outrun other companies, and smaller companies would just inevitably die. So this right. is why I like play with the idea. Well, what if you'd have like a private-public partnership with an automated state-run enterprise and small private business owners, so people could still, like... Oh, I thought my cat was throwing up. So people could still, like, decide if they wanted to buy it from a machine or from a human. That would be, like, an option, but... I mean, the other thing is, when we have universal basic income, would people even still be then convinced to go to socialism, or would it then just be universal basic income forever? And that would be kind of, I mean, that's kind of the way I see it, but maybe there would be a huge crisis with universal basic income. I honestly don't know.
Right. There's too many variables to properly, say a genuine firm solution either way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This is all just speculation, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
The speculation based on what we have at the moment, you know, but it's still speculation anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with I do think, again, maybe I lean a little more optimistic than anything else, but I do think that you know, universal basic income would be leading towards socialism, because I'm curious what would happen if you combined universal basic income with either nationalization of industries in the country, mm-hmm. or state-owned industries like China's doing. Now, obviously, there's, you know, private companies in China, but yep. they are state-run, or at the least the state has a big role to play within those companies. And I'm curious if something similar could be implemented here.
Or there are cooperative, that would also, of course, be something.
Yes, worker cooperatives. I believe Dr. Richard Wolf has talked about that a few times as an alternative to kind of what we have now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be a good way to do things just because, you know, I don't know if anybody knows, but there's a cooperative company in Spain called Mondragon, I believe they're called.
I think I heard this on the Wolf channel.
Of all places. No, but I mean, they've been a cooperative for a few decades now, even through, I think, the Franco era. Mm-hmm. So that would be something that could be workable, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, if at least in our system, until and when we can move to a more socialist system, that would be a good alternative to the massive corporations that we have now. Because if an employee perhaps feels that he has like an actual hand in how the company is run, then perhaps things would go a bit smoother, you know? It's a little similar to what... I don't know about similar, but it does remind me a bit of what East Germany did, in which, you know, every worker had a say with regards to the company culture.
Well, I just think that having like worker cooperatives under capitalism will just inevitably smash them, because they're going to be outrun by someone which is...
Hold on.
Sure.
That's a truck backing up, I swear, not an alarm.
Oh.
All right. So you were saying that worker cooperatives are going to just be inevitably smashed under a capitalist system.
Yeah, because we don't really see a lot of worker cooperatives around, because they're normally crushed by normal capitalist businesses. And we do have, like in Switzerland, the Migros Genossenschaft, which is the Migros cooperative, and it's like a food super. It's a supermarket, but I don't really think it's like a cooperative. I think they just call themselves like that, but I'm not 100% sure. I would have to research it more, because then, of course, it would be one of the biggest cooperatives in Switzerland, and I might actually. That would be a very clever thing to look that up.
Right, yeah. That'd be something worth discussing on another episode.
Yeah, but I mean, when we look at Huawei, which is under a socialist system, then I would say if it's under a socialist system, which means that it's protected, then it can be very, very big and strong and powerful and flourish with a lot of ideas, because cooperatives, of course, allow many ideas. I would even say more ideas, and probably also allow innovation, but I'm not too sure, because, I mean, you are allowing the workers to take part in this you allow your friends to take part in this joint project and to bring in new ideas, which would make you all richer. Yeah.
Agreed. And that would be a good idea, especially, you know, if you have, you know, different ideas and everybody votes on the ideas and discusses it. And then, mm-hmm. you know, once the idea is fleshed out and put forward, everybody would have a vested interest in making sure it succeeded.
Yeah. I mean, there I would agree with Walsh and all the other synthetic left that cooperatives can be strong, but I mean, they won't lead to socialism. What I would do here in Switzerland is nationalize the banks, and with the banks you could hand out loans, and with handing out loans you could have interest, and the interest which is paid back you can use to finance things. Like, for instance, the pension for old people. You could finance new projects for the state, like, for instance...
infrastructure.
Automation, yeah, or infrastructure, all these kind of things. And, absolutely. I mean, the social democrats here always just talk about, oh, well... we need a democratic socialism, and they never really tell you how to achieve that. And the rest they just talk about is taxes. Yeah, I mean, it's really kind of a depressing situation, because people are not that bad off that they're interested in socialism, but they're not that great off that they shouldn't be interested in socialism. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. You're right in the middle where it's not completely bad off, but it's not completely, you know, enough to make them want more. They're in the, yeah, the hazy middle, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah, in America, interest in socialism is starting to grow simply because we are in a very toxic situation. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't even get a minimum wage increase in this country, and getting a one-time check is like pulling teeth, you know?
So when did actually the minimum wage come in? Like, when was that even achieved and by whom?
I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I want to say that came in and around the FDR era, which was like the 30s and 40s.
Wow.
Yeah. But it's been there since then. And initially it started out as a way for one person to support a whole family, you know. That's how it was in the olden days. And it ended up somehow being propagandized into, oh, this is just the bare minimum that a teenager after school could work, or some sort of, you know,
they're abusing
dream nonsense. Yeah, of course. Yeah, they're abusing it. And it tends to be a side effect of the constant deregulation we have had. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, it's also a side effect of the constant outsourcing, you know.
Yeah.
It took me a long time to realize that the reason outsourcing was happening was that it was a form of imperialism. Mm-hmm. And imperialism is capitalism on steroids, or the highest form of capitalism, however you want to say it.
Yeah, sure. Was actually Amazon affected? Because I heard like they never really had a minimum wage there. Like, did they find a way around it, or did they also have to pay minimum $15 an hour, but it was still not enough?
That is the way we did it in the States is it isn't going through a federal system. It's not like a federal minimum wage is $15 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, it's just that the cities and the municipalities and states were the ones to do it state by state or municipality by municipality.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how you ended up with different states and cities having different wage policies. You know, in some places, some states, they will pay you as little as they can get away with, you know, $7.25 or under that. And then in some other states, there's enough of a progressive bent that the $15 an hour is getting implemented. Amazon, I think, was made to pay it, but I think they ended up profiting because they wrote it all off as like tax benefits of some sort. You know, as it's a bit infamous that Jeff Bezos hasn't paid any federal taxes that we know of.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So,
and so it just becomes this side effect of, you know, it's this odd quandary in which the minimum wage would help workers, but I've heard arguments that it would harm the smaller businesses and that the bigger businesses would just be able to absorb it. And that's something that I think needs to be looked into more, because the statistics tend to be manipulated based on what side of that discussion you're on. If you're, you know, against the minimum wage, you'll find statistics to justify that it hurts small business. If you're for the minimum wage, you'll find statistics to say that it, you know, improve the quality of life, but there's nothing concrete at the moment. But I still hew to the old mentality of the minimum wage should be the minimum that a man can feed his family on.
Yeah.
And the one statistic I did find that kept recurring, that kept popping up, was that if minimum wage had kept pace with, you know, production,
mm-hmm,
that we have today in America, it would have been like minimum $22-$23 an hour.
Yeah. So, I see that you are like ideologically, or more, you are educated on Marxism, it seems. What have you read? What are you reading? Like, how did you get into it?
Sure thing. I think the first thing I read regarding Marxism was probably Das Kapital, but I only read I think the first book. And then I moved on to Stalin. I believe it was Fundamentals of Bolshevism, and I'm currently reading Lenin. I'm currently reading Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism, and State and Revolution.
Ah,
So those are what I'm reading at the moment.
you probably mean the fundamentals of Marxism-Leninism, probably.
That's the one, yes. I think it's...
Or the foundation. No, it's actually the foundations of Marxism-Leninism, because the fundamentals of Marxism-Leninism is, the Finnish Bolshevik called it, a Khrushchevite book, but it explains very well how it is connected to man and brain and thinking, and it's very an interesting book. I actually read it.
Yeah, that one I may need to read. I'm referring to the one with that Stalin wrote. Yeah. I think it might be Foundations. I couldn't recall the exact title. So it's I think the thing that keeps me reading is, even if, let's say, some things are a little bit dated, like when they talk about 1848 or things like that, it is a little dated, obviously, but a large chunk of what they wrote is still relevant. And I think that's a large part of its appeal, in the sense that nothing has truly changed, in the sense that, you know, this is...
I would say, like, it is more or less... Has America, like, really changed from 6 FDR times? Like, I mean, sure, you have less working class consciousness, but, like, capitalism itself...
Hold on. You're kind of cutting out a little bit.
The Second World War, like, 50s, 60s, I wouldn't really say that capitalism has changed much in America.
Yes, I would agree with that part, just because, you know, America tended to basically crush any and all of its socialist communist movements at the start, you know, before it could even get off the ground. So that, I think, was something of a drawback, and that's admittedly why perhaps socialism communism hasn't had as much of an expansion as in other countries, you know. And given how the majority of anti-communists, ironically, were originally Trotskyists. You know, you had a lot of people like Sidney Hook and people of that ilk become, you know, Cold War warriors, you know, and vehemently anti-Soviet, vehemently anti-communist. And so that is the tradition that the past few generations have been stuck with, you know, this sense of, oh my God, the Soviet Union was evil and terrible and, you know, all these terrible things. And, you know, look, it's not perfect. It did make mistakes, as every and any country does, you know.
Can you, like, protect your...
Hold on. Say that again.
Can you protect your mic? There's a little bit of wind.
Okay. This should work, I hope.
Great. Yeah, I really realized this with my grandmother and my grandfather when I, like, about nowadays China. I just know I can send them anything, and they won't actually, like, you know, believe what I'm trying to prove, because this has just been so ingrained. And when I look at the old timey propaganda, you can see, like, the Swiss politician Leon Nigol, which is, like, for me, it's like a working class hero here. But he's not very much known in Switzerland. And you can see, like, on a poster, him and a social democratic leader. And Stalin has, like, them as a puppet. And like, Stalin is below and like, acting as if they were puppets. And if you see this type of propaganda, or what was even shown in the news broadcast all the time, you never really knew what was going on there. I mean, it's absolutely no wonder that these people are so scared of socialism, or even a state-run business is considered to them absurd and doomed to fail. But, like, when we look at China, state-run enterprises can work, and they do work.
Precisely, and I think, you know, despite being in two different countries, we've seen sort of similar propaganda, in the sense that, you know, the communist was always creeping around looking to, you know, infect the nation. You even see some of that a little bit, you know, and I used to believe in this conspiracy theory myself. It's called cultural Marxism. You know, and it wasn't until fairly recently there, you know, you have the what's called, for those that don't know, cultural Marxism is that theory in which the Frankfurt School went into Europe from, I think, Germany, and then tried to just basically destabilize multiple different countries. It's one of those things that on the surface sounds true, but then you come to realize that it was ironically the CIA through the Congress of Cultural Freedom.
Oh, really?
Which was an which was a foundation set up by the CIA.
Okay, that makes sense. So is Adorno, is he like a synthetic left Marxist? Because I have like a book of him, and I've stayed away from him because I wasn't sure.
Yes, to a degree. Yes, a lot of these types that came in. You know, the Sidney Hook, who was a Trotskyist. You would have the Frankfurt School and people like that. They are the synthetic left because they were originally brought in as anti-Soviet propagandists. Yeah. That's what it was.
Yeah.
You know, Susan Sontag, people like that. They were supposedly left, but in reality, they were just against the Soviet Union, and that's why they were basically funded by, you know, by the United States.
Yeah.
And so that's, I think, where a lot of people get confused. And it's another reason why people say they're a socialist, but then they start preoccupying on identity politics, is because it's like, no, you're not a socialist. You've just learned from the wrong types, if you will.
Yeah, well, I mean, we do that as well, but we actually,
of course,
we are actually right. And they are the wrong types because they're literally funded by the CIA. But what I didn't know is that the Frankfurt School was funded by the CIA, which is very interesting because I had a flyer in my letterbox the other day, and it claimed like, well, the communists, they are, privatization is happening secretly in Switzerland. Public businesses are or more public thing, public institutions are turned over to private institutions or more to private businesses. And then I read on and it said like, and I kind of thought, well, it's a social democratic paper, which, because it was red, which wants to stop privatization. And then I read further on and then on the back side of the paper, it said, the communists are now following the Communist Manifesto. They want to nationalize everything. They want to take away your rights and they want to take away your freedom. And that's when I was really, 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 really confused. And then I started looking at it a bit more. And then there was like a quote from FDR saying, oh, well, nothing happens without an accident. Like nothing happens by accident in politics. Everything is planned. And then I'm starting to look at the sources because there were like sources listed. And then I saw one link or one URL saying the Great Reset. And then I went, oh, now I know what this is. And I went on this page and then I started writing a really long email because I was like capable of writing my comment there. And before that, I tried ringing him, but he didn't pick up. So when I was done writing it, he rang me and then I picked up, of course. And then we had a really long discussion and he was like into Taoism and he had like on his webpage stuff about Marxism, but also, which I found out later, about the what are they called? Guidestones? The
Georgia, yeah, Guidestones,
the Georgia,
yes.
Guidestones. And how, oh, well, Stalin killed so-and-so people, and that's just the beginning. They want to kill more people. And like on the phone, he told me, well, everything is planned, and all politicians are controlled. And then I asked him, okay, but I've created a party, so am I controlled? And he said, no. But once you get bigger, then these outside people will come, and they would, I don't know, kind of control me. And then I asked him, well, is it then the Jews or is it the Illuminati? And he said, no, it's not the Jews. It's not the Christians. It's not the Muslims. It's, I would have to understand history. And then I explained to him dialectical, historical historical materialism, you know, about the hunter-gatherer society and how it came to class society. And I explained that to him, and he said, well, yeah, but you need to forget all these isms and all these ideologies, and you have to look at who is the founder or who is the creator of these ideologies. Yeah. And like, I had like a hour-long discussion with him trying to convince him, because I basically went into this discussion with him like this. Hello, Mr. So-and-so. I'm an expert on Marxism. I read books from Marx till Stalin and Mao, and I know a lot about Marxism. I've also read the Manifesto. And what you are claiming is not true. Please stop worrying that communists want to, like, you know, take away all your freedoms and rights. And that's where right. I kind of went in like that. And I realized it was also a more of an older person, probably in his 50s, 60s, because he told me, like, he spent 30 years on this, and these documents on his website, they were, like, very, very specific. He even had some documents in English explaining, in some parts, actually, Marxism very good. But I think he just copy-pasted it from Wikipedia. And then
that's my thinking. I think the thing with a lot of these types, conspiracy types, and I say this because I used to be one of them briefly, mm-hmm. They're half right, you know? They get up to a certain point correct, you know? There are people that are trying to damage the world. There are people that are trying to reset the world. There are people that are trying to make a conglomerate, make it a one-world government, if you mm-hmm. will. But communism isn't the problem. If anything, communism is starting to become the solution, yeah. simply because, or at least like a form of patriotic socialism. Because if anybody had read any Lenin, they would know that Lenin had said six cartels or corporations, which is what they called corporations mm-hmm. back then, have more pull and influence than 100,000 small businesses. So that alone is an indictment of the capitalism that we have now. Yeah. And so I'm going to have to start heading out. But before I go, I'm going to just say that, you know, the reason why you and I have turned to communism is because it has been found to work. It has been found to make sense. It has been a way of understanding and comprehending what is going on mm-hmm. around us. And it's only something from there, you know, because in another life, we could have been, you know, right wingers, capitalists, things like that. We could still buy that specific propaganda. But we're realizing that, no, a large chunk of what we're seeing today is quite frankly due to yeah. capitalism, is quite frankly due to imperialism.
So I actually was also a conspiracy theorist, and I know how easy it is to believe something when you're a conspiracy theorist, because you basically
right.
don't look up things in most cases. Like if you see a post on Instagram, you just repost it. But my question is this. Do you actually know what the Great Reset is about? Because I've never really bothered to deal with it, and someone sent me like 1 hour video, and then I thought, well, okay, I mean, if it's interesting, I look into it, but it wasn't really interesting to me. Do you know what it is about, and which people are behind this?
Let me think. If I can basically sum it down into a very quick discussion point, I would basically say that the Great Reset is cartelization, if you will, in the sense that there's going to be a crisis, and the capitalists, the big capitalists, the big millionaires are going to try to take advantage of it. And I've said at length that it's kind of a restart of 2008, in which, because of the financial mm-hmm. crisis, everything became, you know, foreclosed or for sale. And the billionaires just swooped in and bought everything at very, very cheap prices so they can continue to reinvest and make more money. I would argue that's the same thing happening today with the added problem of this pandemic. Yep.
So they want to actually maybe nationalize some things, but just in order so they can still have their profits and everything and keep the system running.
Something to that effect, yes. Yes.
Okay. Because I couldn't imagine that they would actually want, you know, that they would actually want socialism or something like that. And I mean, of course, they are against climate change. I think they are, aren't they? But just because they realized that it would also destroy them.
Precisely. Everything they tend to do is mainly based around profit. And again, that's the biggest problem. If you notice, you know, a lot of what goes on with third world countries or other countries tends to just be debt trap diplomacy, in which you give them a loan, but then you just crank up the interest rates exorbitantly, you know, and you don't give them any genuine way to build. You don't give them any infrastructure. You just give them the money and then you charge them debt. And so that's, I think, what's going on more and more.
To whom exactly? To whom exactly is that happening more and more?
I was going to say, you would see that happening more and more. You would see that happening in places like Africa. You would see places in which they're starting to get rid of the central bank. That's where you see a lot of interest all of a sudden. Notice the U.S. interest in Iran partly is because Iran does not have a central bank. And so that is one of the clashes, if you will.
I thought it was because of the oil.
Well, that's the surface level version, but in reality, it's mainly because certain countries are either not under the influence of the West, or more likely, they don't have a central bank.
So, and you mean a central bank which is controlled by the U.S.?
Yes.
Yeah, now it makes sense, because I was kind of confused because they don't have a central bank because they have decentralized banks. Yeah.
Right. Meaning it's owned by the U.S.
Because that way they can hand out loans to the public, or to private businesses, which work in the interest of the United States. That makes sense. Yeah.
Precisely. All right. And with that, I'm going to have to head to work now. But it's been a wonderful discussion.
And I look forward to many more. 1 minute. So,
yes.
I mean, that's great. It was a very interesting talk.
Perfect time.
And I mean, we plan to talk another time, right?
Absolutely, we will.
I don't actually know how to get out of... here, leave recording. So I'll just press leave recording. So, thank you very much. Frank is your name, because I'm forgetful names. I'm Jason, by the way. So thank you very much. It was a very interesting conversation. And I'm looking forward to talk to you again.
Absolutely. We'll make that happen very soon.
And I hope your YouTube channel will rise. You can actually upload this YouTube video if you want. I can send it to you via whatever. Telegram would work for me if you have Telegram.
Yes, I do. I'll send you my Telegram link later on.
Okay. See you. Bye.
See you, comrade. Thank you.